Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to The Hobcast book show. We are out and about again. Now, we have to be honest with you. This podcast has been recorded on two occasions. The first was not our finest hour. We failed to hit the microphone button. The second was full of wind noise, because we're at a golf course, and you won't get the pleasure now of me hitting very bad shots and swearing.
Always, we could always pretend and just go, oh, what a shot.
Well, we're sitting with a beer, which is a great thing. On a Sunday afternoon, just ahead of England's glorious victory against Italy, or dismal defeat against the Azzurri.
The Azzurri, that sounds quite glamorous.
Just means blue.
Oh.
The Blues. That's their official nickname. But welcome to the show. It is episode 26.
Oh, is it 27?
No, I think it's 26. 26. I think it's 26. Well, it's one of those.
It's in the mid 20-somethings.
It's in the mid 20-somethings. A confusing age when life gets very confused. Welcome to the show. We are Hobart Books. That is to say, my name's Adrian Hobart.
And my name's Rebecca Collins.
You're the Beck, I'm the Ho. And we publish the following.
Books.
In the following genres.
I'm sorry. Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
I didn't even hear that. Crime. I think it was suspense. If you don't mind me saying.
You're being so mean. It's because I've had half a beer.
Yeah, you're slurring already. Well, welcome to the show. We've had a very strange week because we've been apart for most of it. And before I go into the week itself, let's just mention who our guest is this week. Bob McDevitt. Oh, I knew I'd stumble over that. Bob. All right, you do it.
He's had half a beer as well. Bob. I can't do it either.
Bob McDevitt from Bloody Scotland, the director of Bloody Scotland, which is a festival, of course, and has two awards, which are highly sought after by Scottish authors of the following genre. No.
Crime, just crime.
Basically crime. And we have a Hoback nominee in that competition, do we not?
We do. We have the lovely Mark Whiteman. He's long-listed for the McIlvany Prize and also shortlisted for the Debut Crime Novel Prize. So that's great.
Yeah. We've been wanting to get a festival organiser on for some time, but Bob has been doing it for a number of years and in fact runs two festivals. He's the Airight Festival as well, which is based in Glasgow. But we're looking forward to speaking to him, and he reveals a lot about the Scottish crime writing scene and just how unified it is, which is rather wonderful. And a lot of great writers will be at the festival, which is held between the 17th and the 19th of September in Stirling. Fingers crossed. COVID allowing.
Yeah, fingers crossed. We are hoping to attend as well, if we can, COVID willing. So very much looking forward to that, especially after talking to Bob this morning, which will be later in this podcast.
God, our timeline is getting more and more confused. Anyway, we're down at the golf course. I had a few holes. I've been playing golf all week, actually, with my sons up in Northumberland. And I have to say, even though it was supposed to be a break from work and a break from you, it was more challenging than I could ever have imagined.
Yes, I think it's safe to say that if any bad luck could attach itself to you, it really did. And even after that, more bad luck came along your way. Yes, you've had a challenging week.
Yeah, bits and bobs of both sons ill. We've had lost wallets, just stressful moments. We've had to pay for extra room cleaning because one of my sons was violently ill. Just really tough, and the golf was great, but the first day was super wet. We got really thoroughly soaked through, but it was a change of scene. The golf was wonderful at Slaley Hall, but
just difficult, you know, when your poor lad is ill and then the other one gets told to self-isolate halfway through the holiday. It's just, you know, you can't make it up, really.
No, so the whole idea was you were going to have a nice rest from the stresses of life with me in Hoebeck. And actually, I had the most relaxing week and you had a fairly stressful one.
Yeah, you didn't have me being a pain. Anyway, let's talk about the news. There is precious little that we've spotted to really grab us, really.
Yeah, I think it's been a slow week in the publishing world. I haven't found anything particular of note. Although I was browsing through the bookseller yesterday and I was looking at the Rising Star feature, which is where every year they pick rising stars in the publishing world, and it could be in all sorts of areas of publishing, and they're basically people who they think have potential. So that you might not have heard of them. I didn't really know. I recognised a couple of names from Twitter, but it's sort of a way to encourage people who are not far up the ladder in their career, but that they're going in the right direction. But the one thing I noticed that I found quite interesting was a lot of the people who've been selected didn't necessarily have a traditional route to their current job. So the traditional route might be an internship with a publishing house and then through the internship finding a job. So, you know, perhaps basing themselves in London. A lot of them had, through sheer determination, got their job in publishing, because publishing is notoriously difficult to start out in unless you've got some experience or you've got the opportunities presented to you. But these people were so determined that they'd done anything to get a job. You know, they'd worked just enough to pay for their rent, or they'd got temping jobs, or, jobs that sort of were related to publishing, like maybe in the post room or something like that. But they'd, you know, got themselves in through their determination, which I thought was quite interesting, because I often get asked, how can I get into publishing? It's so difficult. How do I get into publishing? How did you do it? And, you know, when I got my job, a lot of it was luck. An opportunity, being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, you worked your own opportunities, really, didn't you? Which was fantastic. Same in broadcasting, really. But, you know, when I started out, there were so many opportunities around the country. Lots of stations needed staff. Nowadays, it's all centralised. Even BBC Local Radio now, they have a fraction of the staff they used to. It's run on a skeleton staff, really. The opportunities just aren't there. But by and large, broadcasting pays better than early jobs in publishing, I think. But I still started out at less than 10k a year, which was just about enough to pay my rent and feed myself, let alone do anything else, really. £600 a month, I think it was, take home.
It's actually about the same. I think my first job was 12,000, but that was a little later than when you started, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, you know, it's...
You're doing it for love.
Yeah, you do it for the opportunity, you want to get on. My next jump up was probably an extra 5,000 on top of that, so, you know, it became a little bit better. But, you know, you're not going to get rich from the media, unless you're, well, Gary Lineker or someone like that.
I'm not Gary Lineker, nor are you.
and that's in a week he's taken a pay cut. So that's a piece of news. I mean, it's interesting, the BBC salaries dropped by, for top earners, dropped by 2.8 million. People like Hugh Edwards, Zoe Ball offered to have a pay cut because her pay was frankly embarrassing at 1.3 million. Gary Lineker's lost £300,000, gone down to 1.3 million, still the highest paid star there. A few other people left, so a lot of big salaries went, but it's still a stupendous amount of money. I mean, Hugh Edwards is on £475,000 a year for reading the news 4 times a week.
I could do that. I would do it for half that.
It's honestly, I know he makes it look easy, and it's not that easy, but it's not that difficult either. I'll be honest with you.
Well, there you go. Maybe that's where you went wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's another story. Well, anyway, let's get into our interview, because it's really a wonderful phenomena, Bloody Scotland. It's been going for its 10th festival, and the 10th McIlvany Award will be awarded, 9th award will be made this year, 10th next year. So it's grown and grown, not least because some very big authors in Scotland have got behind it, like Ian Rankin and Val McDermid, as Bob will tell us. But Bob McDermid is not only the director of that, but also another festival. He's a photographer, And he has, in the past, worked for some of the big publishing houses. So there's a lot of interest and wisdom here in this great interview with Bob McDevitt.
Bob McDevitt from Bloody Scotland, thank you so much for spending some time with us on the Hobcast Book Show.
Not at all. It's nice to be here.
Now, it's a big year for the festival, not least sort of being able to physically, fingers crossed, come back to life and be held somewhere, but also marking a 10th anniversary. So it really does feel as if it's arrived and is now firmly established.
Yeah, I'm glad you said fingers crossed there, because we're still not sure. We still haven't announced anything that we're, so we keep walking this tightrope saying that, well, we hope to be having physical events, and but we're still not 100% sure. But I suppose as time goes on, it's looking more likely. But yes, and it's the 10th festival this year. We can't actually decide whether to celebrate. So it's 9 years since the festival started in 2012. So actually 2022 will be 10 years, but this is the 10th festival. So
right.
We're in two minds as to which one to celebrate. We'll probably do both, which would be the easiest way. But yeah, no, it's going really well. And I think the festival feels very well established for only 10 years. So, you know, we certainly feel that we're one of the crime festivals to watch in the calendar every year. So no, it's great. It's a lovely thing to work on.
What's been the journey for the festival in the sense of you know, the first one to now? What would you say is, how's it sort of developed and expanded?
So it's really grown, which is nice to see. So I wasn't involved at the start. So the festival was founded by two crime writers. So it was founded by Alex Gray and Lynn Anderson. Lynn is still on our board, so Lynn's still involved with the festival. Alex stepped back a couple of years ago. But the two of those two writers, along with Jenny Brown, the literary agent based in Scotland, started the festival in 2012. Quite quickly, they brought on another couple of writers, so Craig Robertson and Gordon Brown, who writes as Morgan Cry, joined the board. And the festival, you know, it's such a cliche, but it really has gone from strength to strength. So it started relatively small, just two venues, you know. We've always had the support of people like Ian Rankin and Val McDermott and Chris Brookmeyer, Denise Miner, so the kind of Scottish crime fiction royalty, if you like, have always been very supportive of the festival. But in just 10 editions and 10 festivals, you know, we've massively increased the amount of authors who take part. Obviously, last year was a bit of a blip on that, and the 2020 festival had to move entirely online. But we still, even that, we used that as an opportunity to develop the festival in different ways. So we had many, many more international authors, for example, join us last year because it was easier to do that via Zoom because we weren't flying people into Scotland. So we had, I think it was something like 15 different countries represented on the programme. It made it much easier for us to have people like Lee Child join us from the US. We had a brilliant session with Ian Rankin and Lawrence Block. You know, Lawrence at his home in New York and Ian in Edinburgh. So, you know, it made things like that easier. And then, yeah, hopefully with the 2021 edition, we will get back to some physical events and panels in Stirling. Although I have to say, we've got a few international authors lined up for this year, which will be online events. They whatever happens, will not be coming to Scotland. So this year certainly looks at the moment like it's going to be a sort of hybrid of the two.
I was going to say hybrid. It sounds like a hybrid festival.
I think that's quite a good solution, isn't it? And that might actually continue after the pandemic.
But I think that's right. I think we've opened that box now. So I think there's going to be a certain expectation going forward that festivals do have, if not everything, then certainly a lot of their content available online. And we just need to work out how to do that.
That's a challenge for you, yeah.
Yes.
Many, many challenges. How important is the support of someone like Ian Rankin to a festival like this?
Well, Ian and Val, we often, I mentioned Scottish crime royalty there. We, you know, we often talk about Ian and Val as the king and queen. Art noir or of Scottish crime fiction. And, you know, we really can't underestimate how important their support has been to the festival. I mean, first of all, they've done all kinds of different things. You know, Ian's played football, Val's played with the band that she fronts, the Fun Loving Crime Writers. Val has presented non-fiction events as well as her novels. They've both chaired for us. They introduce other writers, which is great. So, you know, just an incredible level of support. Ian, this year, of course, we've got a fantastic opening event because Ian has completed a William McIlvany manuscript that was left unfinished when Willie passed away a few years ago. So Ian has been given the blessing of the McIlvany's family to complete this book called The Dark Remains, which is publishing in September, so perfect timing for this year's festival. So we're very, very excited about that. I've literally just got the proof through this week, so I haven't read it, but it's sitting on my desk next up. But yeah, so I think McIlvany left, I think it was about 50 pages of a novel with copious notes on where the book would go, and Ian has finished it off. So yeah, I'm just the perfect Bloody Scotland project, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, to be able to finish off, get your head into someone else's head and finish off a book for them. I wonder whether you would have much of your own style in it or whether you would try and write completely in their style.
Incredible pressure, isn't it? I think the key thing would be the voice. I think the key thing would be to find McIlvany's voice. I mean, it's such a distinctive voice to start with. You know, those books, I don't know if you've read any of the Laidlaw books, but they really are tremendous. All three of the books are brilliant. So I think Ian will have certainly felt that pressure. But I think, yeah, that it is the challenge, isn't it? Obviously, this book's going to be an interesting one because you're going to have McIlvany fans buying it. You're also going to have Ian Rankin fans buying it. The publishers and Ian won't want anyone to be disappointed. So,
Ian might actually feel more nervous than if he was writing one of his own books and publishing that, I would imagine.
That's probably right. In the least if it's his own book, it's all his decisions and it's all his, you know, he's made everything. Whereas this book obviously has been started by someone else. I know a few people who have read the book and have said that it's pretty seamless and that, you know, it doesn't read like some weird Frankenstein monster of a book, you know. Fingers crossed, but yeah, I know I'm very much looking forward to it.
It's interesting. I mean, I haven't read many of the sort of modern retakes of Ian Fleming's works, but I have read Mario Puzo. There were some authors brought in to write further Godfather stories.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was one where it filled in the gap between Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. So effectively, it's the transition to when they moved to Utah. And, you know, they're by the lake and, you know, they're running the Las Vegas thing. So it's those intervening months. And it didn't quite read like a Puzo novel. Mind you, he was inconsistent as well. I mean, he could be a bit patchy. But
that's hard to follow someone who's inconsistent.
Well, it is. I mean, I suppose I look at it from perspective. What I do as one of my lines is narration. And I suppose what I'm trying to do when I'm narrating someone's book is to capture the spirit and the way it's written in terms of, you know, you're trying to capture the spirit of the characters clearly when you're doing different voices, but you're also trying to capture the narrative spirit of the author. And I suppose that's what Ian's doing in a way.
Yeah. The Godfather's a book I've never read, actually. I love the film so much that I don't know whether I've always worried slightly about reading the book because it has a reputation for being a bit of a sort of airport novel, hasn't it? Sort of kind of
airport novel, yeah.
Yeah, and that's okay. Fair. That's fair. I mean, I think what the beauty of the Godfather films, the first two at least, is the negative space. It's the stuff that isn't said. It's the way things are. You know, they create the world, and a lot of it's implied. But within Mario Puzo, he spells out everything. So I don't know. I mean, many people listening to this will be familiar with Godfather 1 to the extent I am. But there's a scene at the wedding where Sonny's wife is using her hands to gesture the size of Sonny's. Manhood. Anyway, that is spelt out in about 3 pages of graphic detail. So,
which would be hard to emulate in a film, wouldn't it? Really?
It would. So that, you know, Puzo.
It's a kind of film, perhaps.
Right. He ladles in. I think Coppola, when they worked together, probably stripped out a heck of a lot of stuff that was superfluous in the edit as well.
But I think I think the films and the books are almost completely different styles and works of art, aren't they? So
yeah. But going back to the book question, I mean, I think that, you know, there's been quite a lot. You mentioned the Bond books there. Obviously, Sophie Hannah's been writing new Poirots, so she's been taking on that, which is, you know, a pretty big thing to take on. And obviously, there's a really interesting one. I mentioned Lee Child earlier as appearing at the festival last year. Obviously, he's about to hand over the baton to Andrew, to his brother. So I think a lot of people will be very interested to see what happens to Reacher when, you know, it's a slightly younger man writing. I think, you know, obviously Lee felt he was coming to the end of his career and wanted a bit of, you know, I imagine he wanted some time to enjoy his money and put his feet up and, you know,
he wouldn't, yeah.
handing over the writing of those books to his younger brother, you know, it'll be an interesting literary experiment as well. So, you know, I mean, I'm very much looking forward to Ian speaking at the festival this year, because I think, you know, we're going to have, you know, a discussion around the genesis of this book as well as, you know, the finished product, if you like, you know. So I think we will talk about how the book came to be.
Absolutely. Can you imagine the fraternal dynamic if it doesn't quite work out with the Reacher books? Does Lee stand over him and go, well, I wouldn't have written that.
or he wouldn't say that.
He's going to have to stand back, isn't he? He's going to have to just let it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's going to be extraordinary. Let's talk about this year's McIlvenny Prize long list.
It's a long, long list this year.
A very long, long list. Yeah, 13 books.
We usually aim for 10 or 12, depending on the scores, but there was nothing to separate the bottom four books this year, so we just felt it was unfair to, you know, to ditch one book just on a sort of numerical tick. So, yeah, so 13. We're making jokes about it being a bookseller's dozen. Or a
bookseller's dozen, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know what you're closely supported by Waterstones, obviously, and they make a big feature of the books when it's announced. Did they roll their eyes and think, oh, how do we fit 13 books onto a shelf?
Our shelves only have space for 12.
quite the opposite. I think the more books, the better for them. So they like to get behind as many books as possible. The good thing about the long list this year is that, you know, it's a real mix of those established names that we spoke about. So Val's in there, Denise Miner's in there, Chris Brookmeyer, Alec Gray. So you've got some real big, you know, heavy hitters of Scottish fiction. But there's also three debuts, including your own book, including Mark's Waking the Tiger. But it's great to see three of the books that made the debut prize shortlist also making the McIlvenny long list. So I just think it shakes things up a little bit. And also, I mean, we make a lot of noise about the broad church of Scottish crime fiction at the moment. I think it's, you know, really interesting that Scottish crime includes, you know, police procedurals and dystopian pandemic novels and historical novels. Craig Russell's Hyde is on the list. There's legal thriller, William McIntyre's Bad Debt. He's a lawyer who has a series of legal thrillers. So I think it's really interesting that, you know, Scottish fiction is not just hard-drinking detectives. There's really a lot of breadth and depth and it's, you know, reflected really well in that long list this year. So.
Yeah,
no,
absolutely.
That's true, yeah.
I was just wondering...
Like we've made it up, but they are genuinely read. The books are all read six times by just ordinary crime readers. So we've got this great band of readers who are... It's made up of booksellers and librarians and, you know, bloggers and people who've come to the festival. And they do the initial judging, because there's just, you know, I think we had 74 books submitted this year. It's too many books for.
So do they volunteer then for that?
Yeah, they're volunteers. They get some free stuff. They get free books and they get some free tickets for the festival. But we don't pay the readers. But they absolutely love it. I mean, when I send out my initial email asking if people want to come, you know, come back and do it again, they're like, oh yes, it's one of my favourite things. I love it. And also, it's quite nice for them because they quite often get books that aren't out yet. So the way the the eligibility for the books submitted to the festival, to the prize, are right up until August of this year. So those books still haven't come out that are eligible for this year's prize. So it's quite nice that they, you know, they might get to read the new Val McDermid or or something before anyone else. So yeah, it's a nice process. But yeah, so the books are scored. Every book's read six times, six different readers, and then I get just a score out of 10, and that gives us our long list. And then the books go to the judges. So the 13 books that are long listed now go to our judges, and they make the final decisions.
It's fantastic that there is this sort of democratic element, in the sense that, you know, these are real readers and, well, you know, and devoted fiction fans of the genre who are picking out these books.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's lots of different ways that prizes are administered around the world, but this has seemed to work for us. We've had some interesting. So, you know, Chris has won the prize, and Denise Miner's won the prize, but last year it was a debut that won for the first time. So Francine Toon's book Pine won the McIlvany Prize last year. Now, interestingly, it was shortlisted for the debut prize and didn't win the debut prize. So, you know, we've given ourselves this potential situation where a book can either win both, so it's entirely possible that a book could win the debut prize and also win the McIlvany Prize. It's equally possible that a book cannot win one and win the other, because it's completely different judges. So,
yeah, you know, that's quite interesting.
It's when you look at prizes and the importance of the subjective nature of, you know, people having different opinions. So,
I mean, that's the only way you can judge. It's like with art, isn't it? Art and literature, you know, there's always going to be a subjective element. You can't, it's not a tick box.
You know, and I've just made the point that the books are very different and, you know, cover lots of different genres within the crime genre. So, you know, it might be that judges don't particularly like historical crime, or that they don't particularly like hard-boiled police procedurals, or that, you know, so I'm more than happy if you've got suggestions, but I can't think of other ways to, or not a way to make it entirely fair and entirely.
No, well, I think this is a fair way though, isn't it? Yeah, because like you say, that one judge might have one preference, another judge another, and then they get to discuss it, I imagine. If they disagree on who should win, do
they? Over a nice lunch, but you know, it's good. I mean, I'm happy to talk about this because I don't play any part in the judging, so I'm there. So I'm usually just sitting making notes and that. But you know, we just let the judges fight it out. And it, you know, it's been some years. It's been very, very a very straightforward process, and it's been almost unanimous. And other years, there's been real, you know, really detailed discussion about why one book and not the other was more deserving, or why one book was better written, or why one book tried to do something different, or, you know, so it's really interesting the sort of avenues that the conversation goes down.
Do they have to stay in a hotel until they make a decision?
No, we try and get a quiet corner of a restaurant, but I'm always terrified of that, of you know, sort of overhearing. Because I mean, the good thing I think about the prize is that absolutely no one knows until the night. So we try really, really hard to keep the winner of both prizes a secret. So we try and get as many of the shortlisted and finalists there in Stirling, which, you know, is a bit mean, because obviously only one person can win each prize, and there's going to be an element of disappointment. But I think, you know, the authors all understand that, and they're all happy to be there. And, you know, being a finalist for the McIlvany Prize means we're saying you're one of the four best, you know, Scottish crime novels published that year, so most people are happy to be in that.
No, I think that's right. Yeah, I think just being part of the process.
Literally, so I know, because I've been at the lunch. We have to tell our press, Fiona, who does our press and PR, because she's obviously got to have a press release ready to go as we announce it. And the only other person who knows is the company. The prize is sponsored by the Glencairn Glass, and they provide us with beautiful engraved trophies. So the person who engraves the trophy knows as well, because they have to. But literally, it's that smaller group. So
people like keeping secrets, though, don't they?
Yeah, I think something like this. Well, it really, you know, it works for us in terms of theatre. You know, it's a bit more it's a bit more of a reveal on the night. So we have, you know, we have a, again, it was different last year because we had to do it online, which was a bit, oh, I felt for the authors last year because they were all just sitting on a Zoom and then they just had to, you know, maintain kind of Oscar faces as the announced. So that was a bit, I think it's different if you're in a venue where there's a bar.
Rather than just going to the kitchen for a beer.
Yeah, and you're with it, and you're with your partner or your publisher or...
And the cat walking past.
Yeah, there's people to commiserate with. And then obviously at the festival, we give the prize first, so it's the first thing we do on the Friday evening. So we're then straight into the festival event. So there's lots of other stuff to do, whereas last year, as you say, it felt people were just sitting in the front room, kind of going, "Oh well, I lost that." But that last year was probably a bad example. That again, it's one of the things we're very much hoping that we will return to doing and giving physically this year. So, and it's nice if you're in a nice venue, and as I say, everyone's got a drink, and then you announce the winner, and there's photographs, and there's a press call, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's exciting.
Mm. Absolutely. And am I right in thinking that Amanda Scott, when she won it, she split the prize?
But she did, yeah. So that again, you can never, you know, it's a live event and you never know what people are going to do. But Amanda felt very strongly that even the idea of, you know, comparing apples with oranges and apples with pears was a difficult thing to get an answer to. So she, although she had won, she had the prize money. So yeah, she had the prize money with three other authors that year. It's difficult, but we still have Amanda listed as the winner of the prize that year. I think we do usually put a wee bracket saying, although she decided to share. But
yes. Yeah. No, that's
That was an unusual thing as well, you know. So,
well, I think that's an expression also of the sense of community I get from the Scottish crime writing scene. Is that what you find on the night and in general, the sort of supportive nature of
I mean, absolutely. I mean, we've not had any sort of sour grapes or any bad mouthing or any, you know, people slagging other writers off. It just doesn't happen. You know, I find the crime writing community to be an incredibly supportive community. As I say, they're very, very supportive of new writers coming through, very supportive of you know, appearing on panels with different combinations of all the writers that we've mentioned already, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's the way to be, isn't it? They all know they're going to see each other at different crime festivals and other book festivals and other occasions through the year. So, you know, much better to approach these things in a collegiate manner rather than some, you know, race to the top.
Yes, you don't want to murder at the festival.
We try to stay away from any sort of political. So there's not. I've never been aware of any discussion of, oh, it's so and so's turn, or you know, they really deserve it because you know the last five books have been. You know, there's. We try to stay away from that sort of thing.
Yeah.
As much as possible, and we had a slightly unfortunate situation in that the first 5 years of the prize was all won by men. So we did have a situation on until Denise Minor won it. Hers was only the second year of it being called the McIlvany Prize, but the Bloody Scotland Prize existed before that. And it was just unfortunate it had all been men winning it. And it's so difficult because you don't know whether you don't want to say, well, a woman's got to win it this year, because then there might be a really great book by a man who would then quite rightly feel that he was being unfairly penalised for other people having won. So it was something we were aware of, but just had to let it play out. And then since Denise won, we've had three women win, and last both winners so far of the debut prize have been women. So it's now seems to have turned around that the men can't win the prize.
Sorry, Mark. Yeah.
sorry about that. But my point is, we try and stay away from those kind of political decisions.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Just let the best book win, or the best book as judged by those judges that year.
Yeah.
You can always make an argument that someone didn't like the book that won, and there will always be that. There'll always be people saying, well, yeah, it was a good book, but it wasn't as good as such and such. And you kind of think, well, the judge disagreed.
That's your opinion.
I think you just have to go for that, so.
But there's been a lot of political pressure around prizes recently, let's be honest. I mean, look at the way Harrogate have been pinged in the last week or so. for not.
Well, yeah, that's not the prize. That's the
point. That was the panelists, admittedly.
Yeah, I do think that's different. I think that's a different thing. I think that we, you know, as a festival director myself, I think it's something you absolutely should be aware of. So I think, you know, I think that's a slightly different issue, and I think they should have been over that. I think, yeah.
Yeah, but there is it seems that in every sphere at the moment, there is a very strong pressure to reflect diversity in everything.
Yeah.
And so how do you, as a director of the festival, react to that and keep that, you know, actually practically address that?
Well, we try to reflect diversity in the program. So, you know, unfortunately, the long list for the prize this year is all white writers, but, you know, there aren't that many Scottish crime writers of colour, so we would love to see more Scottish crime writers of colour. So we are trying to look at the avenues that I spoke about before, so Pitch Perfect and Crime in the Spotlight, which are the mechanisms that we have at the festival for discovering unpublished writers and for giving new and emerging writers a shot at the festival. So we do look at the diversity in those very carefully. We've also partnered up with Harville to promote a new prize, specifically looking for a new BME writer. So the first one, the first winner was announced this year, a terrific book called The Waiter by Ajay Chowdhury. Ajay's going to be at the festival this year as part of one of our panels. So I think it's things like that. I think it's looking for opportunities to increase the diversity. That we make a lot of noises about interesting new voices coming through, and that's exactly what I think this is. Yeah. I think it's just looking for new voices and people telling different stories. I mean, Mark's book, your own book that's longlisted for the prize and shortlisted for the debut prize this year, obviously Mark's a white Scottish guy, but he's chosen to set his debut novel in Singapore and to have a mixed race detective, central character, and take on, you know, and that was, you know, it was something I certainly hadn't read before. It was something that was interesting and new to me. So, you know, I think all these things should be considered.
Yeah, and that was that crossed our minds too, you know, and Mark's very conscious of the fact that he's writing from that perspective, and does he have a right to have a main character from that perspective, you know, from that ethnic background? But we concluded that, you know, from his experience of living in Singapore, it's so authentic in that sense that, you know, he's danced that line very, very carefully.
Yeah.
It's difficult. So in terms of the wider festival scene, you know, fingers crossed, the physical festival happens in September. Harrogate, clearly they've hedged their bets. They went for it. They've made a sort of late call to sort of get the first tranche of tickets sold. And now they've opened it up because certainly in England on July the 19th, Freedom Day, as it's laughingly known. I keep thinking of Mel Gibson shouting something.
Yes.
Freedom. Sorry about the Scottish accent. but they've just opened up the sales of wider festival tickets because they're confident that they can now fill the venues and the, you know, restrictions are going to be lifted. But how much communication is there between yourselves, Harrogate, the Bristol, you know, Crime Fest, all those sort of festivals? Do you have is there a collegiate feel to that as well?
Not really with the English festivals. There's just this year, so partly as a result of the pandemic, Creative Scotland have given some money to the Wigtown Festival to start a Scottish festivals network. So I've been quite involved in the setup of that, and it's been really interesting because across Scotland, I think there's about 52 festivals involved in this network. And that's everyone from, you know, the Edinburgh International Book Festival in Wigtown, and I Write in Glasgow, which I run as well.
Yes.
In Scotland. But then there's some very, very small festivals. So you've got these big festivals, which are, you know, 10 days or 2 weeks or two long weekends or ourselves a long weekend, and then there's some festivals that are just one day, and they're just, you know, they're very much sort of a one person passion project, and sometimes very rural, sometimes very remote. So there's festivals on Cove and Kilcreggan, there's Ullapool, there's the Isle of Skye Book Festival, there's all these kind of things. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. I was just thinking we could have a Norbury festival, crime festival. Well,
they're springing up all over the place, aren't they? So that has had a really collegiate feel. So we've been talking a lot about the digital elements of festivals, and now returning to a sort of hybrid model, how we can do that, how the festivals can support each other with technical expertise and don't make this mistake that I made and all that kind of stuff. So that has been interesting. We don't really speak to other crime festivals. I have to say we don't have much to do with Harrogate or Capital Crime, or I've got a sort of awareness of their programs and I kind of know who's around, and we keep an eye on their prizes as well, because obviously it's quite interesting to see which books have perhaps made their long list or short list that don't make ours. But we've got a unique offering in that the books are all Scottish, so
I think that's quite interesting, though, that you're talking to festivals that aren't crime, you know, the other sort of subgenres of literature. So, you know, you must sort of pick each other's brains in that way as well.
Yeah, because a lot of the organisation stuff is nothing really to do with the genre of books. So the, you know, ticketing and marketing and venue management and all those kind of things, it doesn't really matter what's on the stage. Obviously, it matters from an artistic point of view, for the festival, but there's lots of infrastructure and nuts and bolts and things that we can talk about that aren't really book related. Although, having said that, there's at the network meetings, there's been quite a lot of discussion about really good sessions as well. So some people have said, oh, if you get a chance to include so-and-so on your program, they're really brilliant, or this person did a really great thing for children, or a really good interactive event. Or so there's been a bit of that kind of artistic discussion along with the more day-to-day stuff.
Let's briefly branch away from the festival and talk about, you know, your other side to life. I mean, you're a photographer.
Yes.
And we even have your book here. Published. Which we didn't realise we had. You know, we knew we had the book, but we didn't know it was you.
Yes. So I bought it from the Morecambe and Vice Festival.
Let's spell out what it is.
Okay, this is it's more of a sort of visual book. 101 Men in Kilts.
Yes.
And the cover attracted me straight away on the table of books at the Morecambe and Vice Festival, and I thought, I've got to have this. And I had no idea it was written by you.
Lovely Chris on the front there. He'd be very pleased. So a few years ago I was commissioned. So photography for me was a hobby. So I started at university with film cameras, with, you know, old-fashioned proper cameras. And then with the sort of digital revolution in photography, it was just a hobby that... grew into a sort of, it's a little bit of my income every year. So my own history in book selling and publishing, I worked for Waterstones for many years, then I worked in publishing, first of all in Scotland in London, then set up a Hachette Scotland imprint. So I ran for 8 years an imprint of Hachette books in Scotland. So I was commissioning Scottish crime and history and whiskey and golf books and all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, was made redundant after the great crash of 2008. I was made redundant in 2010, and I started what has become a bit of a sort of portfolio career. So I run a couple of book festivals, and again, until the pandemic, I was doing a bit of photography. So I do a lot of theatre photography, a lot of headshots for actors and writers, that sort of thing. And then a few years ago, I was commissioned by Backpage Press in Glasgow, a small publisher, to do, it's essentially a bit of tourist publishing. It was just, it's exactly what it says on the cover. It's 101 photographs of nice looking men in kilts in different locations. So we did, you know, Stirling Castle, and we did Glencoe, and the Isle of Arran, and Edinburgh, various locations all around Scotland. But it was good. It was really good. We sold 10,000 copies of it, which was kind of amazing. So,
yeah, and I have one of them.
You've got one of them. So we did that. The Morecambe and Vice Festival was interesting because I appeared on a panel at that festival. So there was a panel of other festival organisers talking about just what we were talking about just now, how to run a festival and how to get it off the ground and how to grow your festival and keep it interesting. And when I was speaking to the organizer of that festival, they said, "Well, I think have you got a book out?" And I said, "Yeah, but it's not a crime book, you know." No, just we'll get some copies. That's fine. So that's very nice that one that has made it into the hands of an actual punter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I am an actual punter. Have you not been tempted to write a crime novel then, with all your experience and...
No, I'm not a writer, I have to say. So people ask me this all the time, and I just don't think I've got the... I just don't think I'd have the concentration. I think it's such a big undertaking. I think it's such I think it would take up so much time. And also, books... I'm an avid reader. I love reading. And books form quite a big part of my working life. And I just don't think it's not something I'd want to do with my spare time at the moment. I do a bit of theatre as well, so I do a bit of sort of amateur dramatics, and I do photography. And one of the things that I like about both those things is that they're not book related, and they're not anything really, apart from the Celt book, obviously, which became a book. But as you say, there was no writing involved in that. I wrote a tiny bit of copy for the cover, and that's the only words that are in that book. The rest of it is just, nice photographs. But I quite like switching off from the book world. And I think if I was to now start using my spare time to try and get a crime novel together, I think it may be too much. Having said that, I do occasionally get 30 pages into a book and think, Jesus Christ, somebody could do better than this. This is not, not any good. So who knows, maybe one day if I'm tired and got more time on my hands, I would think about it.
Sounds like you got your hands full anyway. Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time.
No, it's been lovely. No worries. Thanks a lot.
And good luck with the festival, which of course runs from the, 19th to the 21st of September.
No, 17th to the 19th.
17th to the 19th. 17th. See, my memory
is close. They're not quite there.
I'd have turned up at the bar as it emptied. Yeah.
Oh, that would be quite funny if we turned up on the last day. Where's everyone going?
Sorry.
Has the prize been announced? Does anyone know who won?
And don't forget to check out the Bloody Scotland website for the long list for the McIlvany Prize, the short list for the debut prize. It is a fantastic organisation, fantastic festival, and we can't wait to join Mark there and join yourself. So,
best of luck to you as well. As I say, I have no skin in the game, so I can wish you luck without any fear of tampering.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bob McDevitt from Bloody Scotland and the festival 17th to the 19th, hopefully, in Stirling. They're still hedging their bets a little bit, and it's going to be wonderful, and we'll soon enough know the shortlist for the McIlvany Prize, praying that Mark Whiteman makes that, but nonetheless, great achievement to make it to the long list.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So, a month and a bit, isn't it, till we find out whether he's made a shortlist. But and Bob did say to us he has no hand in the prize, so he wasn't going to accept our bribes, damn it.
Not that we've got much to offer. A night with Aki. Maybe. I mean, in her company, I don't mean, anything else. Right. Something struck me. We play this little game, don't we, sometimes, when we get the Daily Mail online up on the screen. And you may have noticed, I think we may have discussed this on the programme before, but they have certain verbiage that they use, busty displays and such like in the sidebar of shame on the Daily Mail Online.
It, the sidebar of shame.
That's what they call it.
Oh, they call it that as well?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, I used to work with somebody who worked for the Daily Mail, and that's what
flaunts
they used to call
it. And things like that, don't they?
Oh, yeah, flaunts, abs, ample assets, whatever. But we've noticed that the bookseller also has its own vocabulary.
Without the assets.
Without the assets, so-and-so. They don't flaunt. But what they do is they talk a lot about acquisitions in the parlance of publishing. In other words, the signing of authors. And they have they really have warped the language a little bit to have a bit of variety in the way they describe it.
For example, Hoberg lands Jenny Ensor.
We snap up Malcolm Hollingdrake.
Secured Robert Dawes.
We preempt. Well, actually, we didn't preempt anybody. That's when you go into, you win a bidding war before it even starts.
I don't think we have been in a bidding war, not yet. Hoberg scoops Wendy Turbin.
Just sounds wrong.
Hobeck clinches Anthony Dunford.
Hobeck scores Harry Fisher.
And we snare. Who should I go for next? Linda Huber.
This is a good test.
And apologies for all the other authors we didn't mention. Out of the 16. Personal. No, nothing personal. Oh, there's more. There's more.
These are the more general terms. Oh, right. So I can't even read my own writing.
Expands. Acquires and expands. So such and such imprint expands their crime section.
Oh,
or,
well, Hobeck could it. You know, expand or, our crime section.
Yeah, or Hobeck acquires Penguin Random House, which is inevitable eventually.
Shh, you're not supposed to tell them about that. That's top secret. In negotiation with.
Oh, the way things are going, we'll easily outrun them. So we're coming for you, Penguin Random House, whatever else you're called now. Hachette Bloomsbury. Yeah, that's just a sample of the sort of things they write on a regular basis. And journalese, I mean, it's awful. In sports journalism, a lot of it's changed because before I joined the BBC, it was a broadcasting organisation only. I've talked about this before. Then they got into CFAX, and so they had to bring in text journalists for the first time. And CFAX required you to write headlines that had a certain number of characters, like 36 characters. And so lots of phrases came in at that point to shorten up the headlines. And it changed the dynamic of broadcast writing suddenly, because they were nicking stuff off CFAX, you know, in a hurry. They started to say things that you would see on CFAX. And it corrupted language, I think.
So would you call that the CFAXization of...
Initially, but then online it became even more pronounced, frankly. And there are certain phrases that they use all the time that I absolutely abhor. So, for instance, when you talk about the Premier League, if you've already mentioned the Premier League in your article, then you'll talk about the top flight.
The top flight? I don't know what that means.
No, exactly. I mean, it's meaningless, really. But, you know, that's what people shove in there just to make it something different. Transfer news. So-and-so, well, they swoop.
Oh, they swoop,
it's scoop,
they?
Swoop. I.
Oh, I know how you feel about the verb I.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a Dan Brownism, isn't it? By the way, if you're submitting to Hobeck any time in the future, if you use the verb, which really isn't a verb, I will ignore your submission immediately. One or two of our writers have slipped them through, and... I've asked them to be removed. They will never be allowed to be published.
That's your particular bugbear, isn't it? He eyed the murderer.
So-and-so says it's a big ask.
Oh, can't stand a big ask.
Horrible. Mm. Horrible phrase. So there's lots of that comes in through, you know, online journalism. Because another problem that BBC sports writers have is that I may have changed now, but the BBC Sport website, because it used to be transferred onto CFAX, they used to take the first four lines of any story and shove them on CFAX. You had to write as if it was for CFAX, so you had the very barest, very, very uninteresting four lines of text at the start of a match report or any form of reporting, and then it would go into the bit that was actually well written and interesting and gave you a sense of what happened. But the first four lines were really bald, I would say.
So you're saying you had to cover the story in four lines?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was a real... It hamstrung everything. And it was a real art to be able to condense it into four lines, but it was a horrible, horrible start to an article.
But do you think that's taught you to be concise?
I didn't have to do too much of it, thank goodness. I mean, I was news editor for the website on sport for 3 months, the toughest 3 months of my career in many ways, just learning a new format, and you know, some of the things that were going on at the time were very difficult to manage, but yeah, I mean, you know, it is a skill. I mean, I know broadcasters who have gone through the CFAX world and emerged as broadcasters at the other end of it, who are superb writers because they waste no words. You know, they keep it very tight and build simple sentences, but very clean writing, but with their delivery, I'm thinking of Mike Costello, who does the boxing and the athletics for Five Live. He is the master of the match report. However, they've got rid of match reports now. They you know, used to routinely hear, you know, so-and-so was at the match, and then there'd be a 30-second, 40-second match report, considered match report. And apart from on a Saturday afternoon, you don't hear them anymore.
No, but I do think that's a very valuable skill. And I know, yeah, the way they've got, they've had to get that skill might not be ideal, but there are so many people who still think the more you write, the better.
Oh, totally. Totally. No, no. I used to love writing an artful dispatch. I loved it. You know, getting a cracking voice piece with a measure, you know, so that people knew, were in no doubt as to what happened and why it happened, but also had some artistry to it. That was my favourite thing to do.
Yeah, and I still think you've retained some of that skill, like with blurb writing, for example.
Yeah, well, that's very kind of me. Just as well. Got to bring something to the party.
Oh, you bring plenty to the party.
Did you miss me last week?
Yes, I did miss you. I think it was quite a productive week. but because I had nobody to distract me in a positive way, as in, you know, let's go and have coffee all. So I just stayed at home and got on with it. But it was a very smooth week. You know, we didn't have anything happen particularly. It was quite a productive week. And then I tried not to disturb you too much with, can you please help me with this? So, yeah, it was fun. It was a good week.
Excellent. Well, back to normal next week. Thank you again for listening to this edition of the Hobcast. I would love to tell you who our guest is next week, but we're going to keep it a mystery.
Yeah, I think that's wise. I think we have to keep it a secret.
We do. We do. It's going to be a fantastic guest, but there's a mystery at the moment. I'm saying no more than that. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the Hobcast. Don't forget again to look at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can get 20% off any of our paperbacks through that website. And also, well, there's loads of content there, just wonderful stuff. Trust me. I wrote half of it.
So is that true? I'm not sure that's true.
Anyway, it has been a wonderful show until this very moment when I got very upset. don't forget to subscribe also to wherever you get your podcast from. And it'll download every week, a weekly podcast, the Hobeck Book Show. But it's time for me to say farewell, Adrian Hobart.
And time for me to say fairway from the golf course.
It's more like shout for right from Rebecca. Thank you very much, and we'll speak to you next week.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.